5 years of age, I guess, they were coming along behind us. And we were going up pretty steeply, and we had already walked about 10 miles. And it was my first real mountain walk. And I would get a little tired and say, could we stop and rest a little bit? And Lawrence would say, oh, Michael, look at those women back. I couldn't let a woman pass me on the trail. Wouldn't that be awful for a woman to pass me on the trail? So we had to push on and push on so as to keep ahead of these people who were absolutely fresh and done nothing all day and were just starting. But then we got to a place up there where there was a little camp or something, and we stopped there, and these women got there. And then we heard them reading from Guy Empey's book, Over the Top, which was the account of an American who had joined the British Army. A very interesting picture of conditions during the First World War. I greatly enjoyed it. I mean, I heard little of it then, but I read it later. There we had a chance with honor to let the women pass us. But that was my first real mountain trip, and I did enjoy it. So I never again hiked with either of these two. And they won the son of the congressman. I don't know if I ever saw him again. But I remember his saying when we left that I did doggone good for a greenhorn. But after that, I just longed to take mountain trips. Oh, I longed to, when I would get together with other students and we would plan weeks ahead to make a trip in the camping in the mountains and plan our grub and everything. And then the night before we were to go, one of them, his uncle arrived from the east and he couldn't go, and so the trip was off. And after about 5 or 6 disappointments like that, I said, after this, if I want to go in the mountains, I'm going, whether anybody else goes or not. If they want to go with me, fine. If they don't, I'm going alone. And I never again after that looked for company to go with me. I practically always hiked alone the rest of my life. But before that, I had thought you had to have somebody with you, of course. I remember one time when I went up in those mountains, and we met another fellow and I were together, and we met someone who said, oh, you're going back there? There's mountain lions back there. Oh, that's dangerous. Your only safety will be to keep a fire going all night. Well, I didn't think there was any danger, but the fellow who was with me, every couple hours when I would wake up and hear him putting some more wood on. But then, I think a little later, I went to that same area, back toward what they call Chileo, and I remember as I went over the hill, I saw a man come walking with a rifle over his shoulder. Behind him, there were two mules laden with equipment. Then there was another man with a rifle over his shoulder. Then two teachers walked behind him, and then behind them another man walked with a rifle over his shoulder so they could be safe from the mountain lions. And when they asked me where I was going, and I told them, and they looked at me alone with no weapons or anything, they were quite aghast. But I never had anything more in all the time, all the many, many trips I took back in those lovely mountains. But that was grand to get a trip back there. And then I heard that Mr. Bailey, who taught English at the school, and Mr. Newell, who taught history, they were going to, again, as they had in some previous years, conduct what they called Sierra Camp for Boys. And they would take 20 or 30 boys and take the train up to Yosemite Valley, stay there a few days, and then hike in the hills around, up in the high mountains above Yosemite. And I went there in the summer of 1917. Oh, what a glorious trip that was. That got me really started in the high Sierras. Oh, how I did enjoy that. Oh, I should mention that during that spring, back in Calumet, I remember going to somebody's house and they referred to President Wilson. They said, he's a good letter writer. He's a good letter writer. What because Wilson said we were too proud to fight, and, you know, we wouldn't mix in European conditions and all that, and some of them were pretty aroused about that. And then one morning there, I heard the boys walking down. I often used to hear them call them Times, Examiner, Paper. They were the two Los Angeles papers. And this morning they were going down yelling, "War has been declared. War has been declared." Huh. And the United States had entered the war in Europe then. And soon after that, they began taking the boys who were older than I was out of the high school. I don't know whether any of them got to Europe or not, the boys did. I knew in high school. But there was quite a number of them that went off to camps, stayed training camps for a few months before the war was over. Hmm. Yes, but during that summer.
Even out of high school?
Yeah.
There was conscription out of high school.
Well, now, I'm not sure whether there was conscription then or whether it was voluntary. I just don't know. But I enjoyed the time there in the high school. I had one interesting thing that rather pleased me toward the end of that year. Seems there was a fellow named Fagan, who I liked very much. His last name was Fagan. There was another fellow named Hodges, whom I did not particularly like. But the fellows whom I would think of as the better moral class, they were largely supporting Don Hodges for student body president. And the more rough and rowdy type were supporting Fagan for president. And they had the election in the high school. And they came to me, some of the supporters of Fagan, came to me and said that they needed an observer to observe the counting, that it was all fair. And would I come? And I told them, well, I said, I had voted for Hodges in the election. Well, they took me anyway as their representative. And I was rather pleased with that idea they had of my honesty.
Sure.
Yeah.
Now, why, not liking Hodges, why did you vote for him?
Well, I liked who he represented. I liked I would say if I were to pick the fellows I liked best in the school, they mostly were among those who supported the Hodges, while if I selected the fellows I disliked the most, they would be with those who were supporting Fagan. But of the two individuals, I liked Fagan the better.
Huh, that's interesting.
Yes, I don't know why it was I did not have such a pleasant feeling toward Hodges. I don't remember. Was it anything I had against him? Just his personality didn't impress me as nicely as Fagan did. I really didn't know either of them particularly well. In fact, I happened to be thrown with Fagan a bit more than I was surprised. I remember the election. We never had anything like that in Calgary. They had the election, and some of them got little cards printed, so-and-so, for student body president, he will do his bit for you. The phrase, to do your bit, was the big phrase in England at that time. You may remember. Of course, we heard lots of war songs in those days. Those old World War songs.
Over there,
and somewhere in France is a lily close by the English rose, this also green, and the shamrock so keen, and every flower that grows. There were, and of course, Tipperary. Tipperary bought the book. If this letter you don't receive, please write and let me know. And if you find mistakes in spelling, Patty, Molly Dear said he remembers the pendants bad. Don't lay the blame on me. That was the song all the British soldiers sang marching, you know. Of course, they didn't care about Tipperary particularly, most of them, but it was suggested home.
Sure.
They thought of the Irish boy in London, goodbye Piccadilly, farewell Leicester Square, and all that. The soldiers from London actually would sing that, of course, reminding them of their home, of against distant places. That was a great summer, that summer after my junior year. And I came back and we went down to the shore for a month or so, Balboa Bay, which was a lovely bay, and then you had the ocean right near. It was a very, very pleasant summer. And I think the school dropped Mr. Bailey. I think they did, and some of the students were very put out about it. I think he was one of the best teachers they had. I don't just know why they dropped him, but I remember some of the fellows being very put out about it. And the next fall, a boy introduced himself to me in the high school named Bernard Lindstrom, whose parents were missionaries in Japan. He and I became very good friends during my senior year there. And then I started at Occidental, and he started too. He had an older brother, Siegfried Lindstrom, there. But he was a fine runner, and he got in with a rather rough bunch. And eventually the two of them slipped away from Christian things, I think. And they moved up to Berkeley, to the University of California. But he was one of my best friends. Another of my best friends was a fellow who entered the school my senior year, whose name was Stone. We called him Robert Stone, but his middle name was Malcolm. He came from Dillon, Montana. And his family, his father, his mother, and he and a couple of other children had moved down and lived rather near us, and he went to Franklin High School, and he and I went around quite a bit together. And then he went to Occidental for 1 year, and then he went to University of California. Oh, he was with me at the Presidio in the summer. And he went to University of California, and then I didn't hear of him again. And about 10 years ago, I stayed overnight at a little motel up here in near Hamburg, Pennsylvania, where I'd often stayed when I would walk along the Appalachian Trail. And the man told me, I got to know them fairly well, staying there so often, and the man mentioned to me how he and his wife, the summer before, had driven out to Arizona to see an old friend of theirs, and then the friend's brother, they had gone from Arizona north to Dillon, Montana to see the friend's brother. And a year or two after that, they mentioned to me they were going to make a trip west to Arizona again. And I said, are you going up to Dillon, Montana again too? And he said, yes. And I said, well, if you're there, see if there's a man named Robert Stone who might have some connection with the bank. His father had been connected with the bank, vice president, I believe. I thought he was president. I believe it was vice president. And the next time I went to the place, they had a little thing on their table where you register, a little calendar they put up there when they saw me coming that had at the bottom R.M. Stone Real Estate.
Hmm.
And they had a brief note for him, and I wrote him a letter, heard nothing more for 3 or 4 months, and then all of a sudden one day the phone rang and I picked it up and he said, this is Malcolm Stone from in Dillon, Montana.
Huh.
I thought that was an interesting coincidence.
Yeah. He had been in your high school?
He had been in my high school, kind of a crazy fellow. When he first got there, he used to take the yellow car and always take a new route, so he saw all the areas around Los Angeles. He was kind of a crazy fellow. He introduced me to various things that I just as soon not have gone to now. They weren't bad, but they were leaning in that direction a little bit. And but I used to take him places. I had a pretty good time with it. It's strange how I often, other places too, I would find I would have two or three different friends who would have no use for each other, mm-hmm. with whom I would be very good friends. I had that experience a number of times. And my other friends had no use for Robert Stone, I remember, at that particular time. But I hardly thought of them all those years, and then
to have that coincidence.
Yeah, I thought that was most interesting. Yes. Well, the during the next summer, the war was on. The Germans were advancing. It looked as if the war would last for many years longer. The boys mostly thought they would all be in the trenches before long.
This was the summer of 18?
Summer of 18. And
you had just graduated.
I graduated from high school, and I worked in an olive ranch during that
summer. Was that at the Presidio? You mentioned being at the Presidio.
That's the next year. That's 1919. I worked at this olive ranch during the summer for a little while. They had a bunch of they had big olive trees, but they had a bunch of boys picking the cucumbers between the olive trees. And I used to, I lived out there with them and worked there, and to help in the war effort, of course. And when fall came, I entered Occidental College, and soon after I entered, they announced they were going to have reserve officers training corps there, and the all the boys were inducted into the Army. Whether this was volunteer or draft, I just don't know, but they all were drafted that were 18 or over. Well, I was one of the very few in the school that were, I was only 16, right. Very few that were under 18. So the result was that soon they all had uniforms, and I was one of the very few that were wearing civilian clothes. The attendance, our entering class was as large as any other two classes in the school, because people had a chance to avoid being drafted right into the Army as privates by going to college, and they could get into the officer's training corps. But they soon were all in uniform, and they were marching and so on. I was out of that, but I was in classes. I took a course in trigonometry, which they had two sections of 60 each, because they were hoping to get into the Navy. And after the war was over, in the middle of the semester, this class dropped to one class of 30. Of course, a lot of people dropped out of school then. But that was in the fall of school with all these fellows in the Army. Oh, we got school well underway, and then one or two people got flu, and then a couple more. And about the third day, I came down with it, and so I was home. And then Stone was home, and then 3 days later, the school was closed, and most of the students were, they turned the school into a hospital. Huh. Most of them had the flu.
This was the fall of 1918.
Fall of 1918, yes. When I had the flu for 3 days, I was so weak, I could hardly move. I lay there in the second floor in the bedroom, and my mother's second cousin and very elderly man, Henry Jennison, who was so weak, very weak and old, he walked up the three blocks from his house, and they didn't think they should let him in the house. Father and mother were away for some reason that afternoon, and my aunt went out to talk with him, and talk with him out on the lawn, because they better not bring him in the house. And she shut the door, and the latch was on, and she was locked out. So she called up to me, would I please take the key that was on the bureau and throw it out the window? And I got up out of bed, walked to the bureau, picked up the key. By the time I got to the window, I was so exhausted I could hardly stand up. All I could do was just to throw it out of the window without looking, and then get back to the bed as fast as possible. Took her an hour hunting in the grass to find the key. But just shows how that flu test. People died. Doctors and nurses, so many died. And it was 6 months afterwards before many of us had our full strength back.
Huh.
Well, that flu was a terrible epidemic at that time. It was our first big epidemic of flu. Before that, when I was a boy, we'd often hear of somebody who had the grip. And grip was a common name. I never heard of flu till then. But, of course, the word grip has disappeared now. It's all flu anymore.
Yeah.
Huh. Yes. But the school was closed, and for, I guess, a month or so. And then I remember the Armistice Day. We went downtown. Everybody was yelling and ringing bells and so on. And we didn't know whether we should have done that because of the flu. You weren't supposed to go in crowds or anything.
Huh.
But it was a big celebration day, that Armistice Day. And incidentally, when Robert Stone was also under 18. So after I was recovering from the flu, he came over to see me. And we were both in a class in English literature. Lamb, De Quincey, Landor, and Macaulay, I believe. And they were using a system of identifying certain features. They had 10 common features and then 10 more for each writer, and you were to locate those. And Professor Liddell had been assigning large assignments. We may have had 3 or 4 classes or so. So he came over, and we figured we'd been out of school for maybe 3 or 4 weeks before the school closed, I guess. Anyway, we figured how much ground they would have covered, and we got busy, and we really covered that ground. And when we got back to school, we found that the big assignments that the professor gave, hardly anybody did. And the result was that we learned more about Charles Lamb's writings than we did about all the others put together. And it gave both of us a tremendous start on that. Work. Now this Odell was, we all had, all the juniors practically had, first students, freshmen had Odell's class, and they voted that they would take him as their advisor. And we had practically no contact with him after that first year. Practically none, until we came to the senior year when he was still our advisor, so he featured in the commencement. Occidental had, on the whole, a good education, but it was quite inferior to what we had at Calumet High School when I was there, though probably better than a lot of other colleges.
But after being a hospital, some of the college buildings, they made up the time and got through that first year okay?
I don't know how they did that. They, first classes dropped in size. I don't know whether they postponed the time of ending the first semester or not. I don't remember the details.
I had never connected the influenza of 18 with the armistice that way. It's interesting how you said that you were even a little afraid about the crowds and all that.
Yes.
I hadn't somehow ever made that connection.
Yes, the flu came to our area 2 or 3 months before the armistice.
Hmm.
But it was,
had it reached other areas earlier in the year, or did it travel across the country?
I think it started there. I think it came from Asia and started in the West and rather rapidly went across the country. But I think our areas where it started. My first 2 or 3 days in bed, I kept hearing about the different ones in college we've gotten. So by the time I was beginning to recover, they were having great many. They were having so many had it that they just closed up the school. But I don't remember what they did about that. I do remember that toward the end of the year, the fellows who had been in training camps began to come back to school. And as they came back, oh yes, the school had ROTC, so when we went back, we put on uniforms and marched around with the rest. And Then the fellows who came back, some of whom had been in the Army for 2 or 3 or maybe 4 years, maybe an Army training camp, they didn't like this ROTC business. They disliked it very much. Didn't think we should have it. We had a meeting. I remember at which they had a protest meeting of the students against having to take ROTC, and we all sat around the students in this place, and then the major who was in charge of it now came up and he looked at us and he began to talk, and he talked straight ahead for 40 minutes and everybody sat and just listened. But they were quite hostile to the whole thing.
Because they had already had this training?
My guess would be that it was the fellows who had been in the Army and had it, and they didn't see any point in carrying it on, and that their attitude conveyed to the rest. I don't know. But when the next summer came, we were told that we could go to the Presidio for ROTC training if we would like, and so Stone and I both went to the Presidio. There was maybe one or two others from Watson now. But there were a lot in the training camp up there from the from military schools in the East, people who lived in that area. And quite a varied group from universities in the area. They arranged us all in the Presidio according to our height. So I was two-thirds or more down the line. But we were arranged according to height. We had all our whole company. I don't know how many would be in the company, 15, maybe 80, 100. I don't know how many were in our company. But we had one room, which we slept at our cots in it. We had military training. We had training in bayonet drill. And Stone would, and I had some pictures taken of us with bayonets sticking this way, but he contrived that every one of the pictures would have his bayonet headed right for my stomach and my bayonet kind of up in the air. But I enjoyed the 6 weeks at the Presidio very much. Of course, the war was over then, but it was a pleasant time, very interesting. We would go out into the parade ground, and there we would have our bayonet exercise and different things, and we'd stand and hear men talk who'd been in the Army and the officers in the Army over in France. And they give us various instructions. The last 3 days were maneuvers, which were quite interesting. But the thing about being in the parade ground there was they had these little planes, which was all they had in those days, straight above us doing stunts, turning around, you know, with the head down or reverse, with the tail down, all these stunts, and just to watch them when we've practically never seen a plane before, it was hard to keep your attention on the instruction we were getting. Huh. And there was a man from India. I think he'd been a missionary in India. He was taller than I was, so we weren't right with him, but we saw him a bit, and he was he was a real nice fellow, and I only saw him 2 or 3 days, and then he disappeared. And I went and visited him in the hospital. I had talked to him one evening. He was taking his rifle or with the bayonet on and showing me a little bit of how the British Army did or something. And I went back to my bed, and next I know, he had dropped his bayonet, I guess, which was on the rifle. It landed right in the middle of his foot. Uh-huh. And so he was, the last 3 weeks or so of our time there, he was in the hospital. So I didn't see him further. Stone used to go off with some other fellows and get drunk. Come back at night and so on. And actually, I don't think I ever saw him again after the time at the Presidio. He didn't come back to Watson.
And then you entered your sophomore year at Occidental.
Yeah. Now, during the first year, there was Stone, there was Gordon Sawyer to go to high school. I'm intending to be a physician, go to medical school. The four of us made a trip to Santa Barbara together. And we saw, I think, McAdoo was sitting over in the room, eating in the dining room where we were at the restaurant, which interested me. We had a lovely trip riding up.
And so now we're...
How much time do you want on the sophomore year?
Well, maybe 3 minutes. I don't know. It depends on what you think. Let me know when you're ready to start. Okay. Good afternoon. It is Friday, April 28, 1989. This is an oral history interview with Dr. Alan Alexander McRae, the Chancellor of Biblical Theological Seminary, Hatfield, Pennsylvania. The interview is in the conference room at 3:45 p.m. approximately. And we are commencing where we left off a few years ago with Dr. McRae's, beginning of Dr. McRae's sophomore year at Occidental College. We had done four cassettes, which led up to that point, covering the period 1902 to 1919. And so I thank Steve Haig, the tape engineer. I thank Dr. McRae. I'm Jim Pakula, the librarian of the seminary. And we shall commence Dr. McRae then to discuss the fall, the summer and fall of 1919 and your remaining years at Occidental College. And I would like you to include any observations you like about your church attendance, your reading at the time, interaction with certain events and individuals, preparation toward looking towards seminary, and so on.
Thank you, Mr. Pakula. And it's very pleasant to review these old memories and to think back to those days. It's hard to know what to select because each memory brings back others associated with it.
Sure.
But you mentioned the summer of 1919, and during that summer, the World War I had just finished the previous fall, and I was in the ROTC at Occidental College, and we were given the opportunity to have 6 weeks of training at the Presidio in San Francisco, and that was a very interesting experience. There's a beautiful place there, right on the Pacific Ocean on one side and with the San Francisco Bay on the other. And I was with some other fellows from Occidental and then from many other schools. And I had a number of interesting experiences there, which I don't think I'll take time to mention, except the fact that it was very sad to me to see some fellows come in there who seemed very decent, bright, clean fellows, and then as all around them, fellows were making terrible rotten talk and language that by the end of the time there, they were among the worst. That had absolutely none of that when they came. Mm. It showed how easily influenced young fellows like that can be. At the end of it, I went to a church in San Francisco, and it was a Presbyterian church there, Sunday evening, where I heard a very interesting address by the minister on Ireland during 50 years. And it was historically and sociologically a great experience, but I could not but feel, if that's what they're doing, using the church service for, we've gone a long way. Well, I spent 5 years at Occidental, and I've always been thankful for them. It was a time of growth, a time of increase of knowledge, a time of learning to deal with other people. It was a small school with about 500 students, and I've always been thankful for that because it gave me an opportunity for various types of experience, which I could not have had in a large institution. In a large institution, if you wanted to become a debater, you'd have to spend a great deal of time on it. If you wanted to work for the paper, that'd be about all you could do. But in a small school like that, I was able to enter into many types of experience, which gave me a valuable training. I learned to deal with people much more than I would in a large institution. The teaching was, on the whole, well done. The faculty was knowledgeable. Most of them were good teachers. But it was a great shock to me when I first got there to see the attitude that the professors took toward our country. The professors, I did not realize then that the professors in all our small colleges, if they're going to have any standing, have to go to the great universities, and there they get certain attitudes instilled into them. And I was used to a strongly patriotic attitude in the high schools I had been in, and there I found that the general attitude was quite critical of the United States from the founders on down. Now, Occidental was a Presbyterian institution. It had been under the Presbyterian Church, and then Andrew Carnegie offered them a large sum of money, but with the condition that they must break their ties with the denomination, which they did. And they always insisted that their teaching remained exactly the same, and they were just as strong on their Christian attitude as they would have been if they still were connected with the denomination. Well, whether that was a big factor, I don't know. The first semester I was there, I went into I was in a course in history, and a woman teacher mentioned the discovery of an ancient people, the Sumerians, the most ancient yet known, and told a little bit about them. And I raised my hand, and I said, were they antediluvian or post-diluvian? She said, what? I said, were they antediluvian or post-diluvian? She repeated her question. And I again said, oh, she said, they were so far back the flood doesn't even enter into it. Well, I didn't see how that could be. It was either before the flood or after the flood. It couldn't be so far back the flood didn't enter into it. And that was, you might say, my first beginning of feeling that there was, at least in some of the faculty, an anti-biblical attitude. The professors were all professing Christians. We had chapel every day, required attendance at chapel. Smoking, drinking, dancing, all such things were forbidden. And it had a background of a very Christian attitude. The principal place when I entered where you would feel the absence or the change from it was in the fraternities. There were two strong fraternities when I first got there. The OMA, these were local fraternities at that time, the OMA, which had many of the leading fellows of the school, some of the best athletes, I think on the whole a fairly good standard. Then the Owl and Key, which contained some of the a great many athletes and quite a number of the men who used very bad language most of the time. One fellow whom I knew who joined the Owl and Key, who fine Christian fellow, at least he was when he came there, he said that when these fellows use these words, they don't mean that. He said, that doesn't enter to their minds at all. He tried, you know, to explain it all the way. He said, say, if you could see the what they put you through there in entering, the way they treat you, the ceremony.
Hazing period or whatever.
Well, the period, yes. Yeah. So they had evidently a big ceremony they went through in receiving new members, and that he said that it was all the most biblical thing. He said, you would think they would all become missionaries after what they go through in being taken into the fraternity. But the fellows were among the most profane on the campus of this school, and it showed something of how things degenerated. But on the whole, it was a good atmosphere.
Now, were you a history major from the beginning?
I guess so, yes.
And so you finished your BA in history in the spring of 22 and
yes.
Then took 1 year for your MA?
That's right.
Okay, so you were there from 1918 until the spring of 1923.
That's right, yes. And they had an organization they called the YMCA, which was a student organization, and it was, I think, quite a good Christian influence on the campus. There was a strong student volunteer organization but I, never having felt the call to foreign service, did not have close relationships with that.
Now, did they have Sunday services, too, that all the students attended, or
no.
Did you go to different churches?
A great many of the students, like myself, mostly commuted. They did not have anything doing there at the college when I was there on Sunday. I would say that the bulk of them went to the Eagle Rock Presbyterian Church, which was about half a mile north east of there. My family lived in the opposite direction, about a mile and a half away, and we attended the Highland Park Presbyterian Church, which was about a mile and a half in the opposite direction. So I went to the Eagle Rock Church once in a while, but not as a rule.
And you commuted by interurban
no,
line
I,
or
no,
by car? Oh, but you walked home each weekend?
No, each day.
Oh, each day?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The first year, I lived at home and walked back and forth every day, except one time when I stayed in the dormitory for a few days. The second year, there were a group of the Christian fellows who organized what they called the Kenilworth Club, to be not a fraternity, but a Christian house club. And this included a number of fellows who'd been away in the army, and because of my second year, they'd come back. And they were very fine Christian fellows, and after that, I never knew at noon whether I would stay in the Kenilworth house overnight or whether I would go home. back and forth. Well, I drove once in a while, but I usually walked.
Now, did you walk to church too as a family?
No, well, we always drove to church, but I often walked home because I liked the exercise. And one of the professors once warned me that maybe wasn't good because somebody might think I was not on speaking terms with my family.
And what was the Highland Park Presbyterian Church like?
Well,
did they have more than one minister?
No, they had one minister. Camel Coyle was a pretty good preacher. I thought he had good message. He was a good Christian man.
Did he influence you at all to pursue an M.A. in history or to go to seminary?
I don't think he ever had any great influence on me. No. He had very flowery language, and when I asked to be ordained, he gave me a letter which said asked that as I go to Europe to study, that the presbytery enable me to go with the diadem of ordination on my brow.
Now, have you been licensed and under care before
no,
that?
That's another story. That comes at the end.
So you still weren't under care of presbytery or anything?
I was taken under care at 10 o'clock one morning, licensed at 10:30 and ordained at 11.
Oh,
and well, let's just get way
ahead. Okay,
this
well,
is 3 years later.
Since
you asked it, let me just say that they had many people who graduated from the Los Angeles Bible Institute who wanted to be ordained, and the chairman of the committee on licensing and ordination felt his great object in life was to keep people from being ordained who weren't properly prepared academically. So when I came with an M.A. from Occidental and another M.A. from Princeton University and a graduate of Princeton Seminary, he wanted to show that this, but I had not been even under care till that day, he wanted to show that this wasn't a shortcut case like the shortcut cases he wanted to avoid. So he just made it sound as if I was one of the greatest scholars in the world. It was really funny.
How about that?
Yeah.
Dr. Lipscrack.
Yeah.
Could you explain a little bit what was going on theologically within the Presbyterian Church during those years, and in your church as well as Occidental?
Yes. I think the best time to give that would be at the end of the college course. I think it'd be better to stick to the college for a little bit, but don't let me forget that. break up, but I think that'd be better to give a little bit later. First, perhaps a little.
And also, we want basically your biography and chronology. Because of course, on the many tapes from church history and everything, we do have a fair amount of your comment on the history of the Presbyterian Church. So, but whatever. We're now up through the. When did you decide to pursue an MA then? And what were your junior and senior years like? Okay, you had no idea then until your fourth year that you were going to, were your plans,
Let me tell you about my second year. They formed this Christian house club at Kennewick.
Mm-hmm.
I think as the years went by, I saw what the anti-Christian influence was. More and more, I felt as it was coming in. Perhaps a word about the presidents of the college while I was there. The John Willis Baird was greatly beloved in the East here as a great Christian speaker and a worker. Well, he went to California and became president of Occidental College, but he left the presidency a year before I went to it, and the students were devoted to him, and everyone seemed to think he was a very fine Christian. But then they got a man named Silas Evans, who had been president of a college in the Midwest. And Silas Evans, I think, was determined to to change the school radically. And he went too fast and aroused opposition. And after 2 years,